Hi, welcome to Motorcycle Views with me, Dave Marsden, here on Fab Radio International, brought to you by Z-Power, Kawasaki parts specialist. This show is all about news, views, information and anything else going on in the motorcycle world. We'll have guests, tips, travelling advice and reviews on anything motorcycle related. You can email us at motorcycleviews@yahoo.com. I'm joined also by my wonderful producer, Michelle. So let's get on with the show.
Hello everybody and welcome to show 11. On this week's show we've got part one of our interview with our very own Steve Berry. We've got a road test, this time it's on the Suzuki V-Strom 1000, well 1050 actually, 1050 XT. We've got our top 10 and we've got an interview with biker extraordinaire Kev Johnson. But first, let's do a little bit of news. Okay, we've got the bike sales figures for April 2020 in now. And not surprisingly, they're well down. They're actually down 83.5%, which could be worse. The equivalent car sales were down 97%. So only 1,623 bikes were registered in April 2020. That compares to 9,820 in April 2019. So you can see the difference in figures. Now, 38% of these sales were scooters, which was probably to essential workers. Now, the worst class affected was the touring sector. They were down a whopping 96.3%. Not surprising, really. I don't think many people were doing any touring. Honda did best, selling 312 bikes. Probably all 125 scooters, of course. Biggest selling bike, well, despite the lockdown and everything else, it was still the BMW 1250 GS. So all in all, pretty bad. I can't see May being any better. The only good news on the horizon is that it looks as though most bike dealers will be able to reopen pretty soon. But whether they can have people in the showroom, it might just be click and collect, I don't know. Oh, what a bag of poo. Anyway, the government in England has lifted the restrictions on riding as from yesterday, Wednesday. Obviously, you've still got to do some social distancing, so when you do arrive anywhere, you won't be able to mix with anyone. So at present, you can't ride into, say, Wales or Scotland if you're in England, because there's only England that's actually lifted the restriction. But I'm sure that'll follow soon. But in any case, guys, please stay safe. Now, after what our Steve Berry said last week about the need to make electric bicycles to have tax and insurance and be registered, well, now it looks like that won't be happening. The UK government says it won't be necessary. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? I'm not sure myself. Anyway, that's it for the news, but I've got this week's question. I'll tell you the answer later, of course, but what bike was the first AMA Superbike Series winner? That was the American Superbike Series, started in 1976. So what bike won the first series? The name of the bike and the model would be good. I'll tell you at the end of the show. First up is our road test on the Suzuki V-Strom 1050 XT.
This is Fab Radio International.
The Suzuki DL1000 V-Strom has been around since 2002. That's a long time. Having said that, there's only been three real different models. So the one I'm testing today is the new V-Strom 1050 XT. That's the top of the range one. There is a standard version, but we're going to do the XT today. Okay, let's do a bit of spec first. It's a 1037 liquid-cooled V-twin. It's got double overhead cam and four valves per cylinder. It's six speed. It's got 107 brake horsepower. That's about eight brake horsepower up from the older model. 74 foot-pound of torque. Euro 5 spec, of course. It's got 43 millimetres KYB front forks. Chain drive, of course. It's got three driver modes. Cruise control, ABS, ride-by-wire, traction control. And it's got automatic idle speed control, which basically means that it's pretty difficult to stall it. Now, it's also got what Suzuki calls Suzuki Intelligent Ride System, which basically is a suite of electronic aids like hill hold control and a few different things which you probably never realise you've got. They're just there in the background. Now, it's fitted with a 19-inch front wheel and a 17-inch rear wheel. On this XT model, of course, they're wire wheels. On the standard bike, they're alloys. It's fitted with Bridgestone tyres. The seat height is 855mm, which is quite high, but it is adjustable. It weighs 545 pounds. It's got a 20-litre tank, which Suzuki claim around about 48 to the gallon, so that should give you at least a 200-mile range on that tank. It's got 12-volt sockets as standard. It's got full LCD clocks and LED lights. It's got twin plug cylinder heads. It's got like a little set of crash bars, well, it has on the XT anyway. It's got a centre stand, and it's got an adjustable screen, although it's manually adjustable, and you do actually have to get off the bike to adjust it. And it's got handguards. Now, the price on this XT is $11,295. The base model is about £10,000, but knowing Suzuki, there'll be massive discounts on those prices. Now, it comes in three colours, the XT, that is. It's red and white, which looks more like an orange to me, but yellow and black, and a black. As you probably guessed by now, I'm not too keen on black, but it doesn't look too bad, actually, because there's a lot of shiny bits on it as well. Suzuki claim a top speed of 130 miles an hour. Now, Suzuki have tried to model this on their old 1980s bike, the DR Big, Dr. Big, and it does look a bit like it with the beaky fairing and the front fender, but yeah, they've done a good job. Now, I've had plenty of V-Stroms. In fact, when I went round the world in 2004 with Nick Sanders, it was a new V-Strom that I chose to go on. Not because I particularly liked it, it was just that it was the cheapest new adventure bike at the time. However, having said that, I grew to love it and I did like over 80,000 miles on it. In fact, I've had six V-Stroms and I've had three of the Kawasaki version of it, which is the KLV-1000, which is really a rebadged V-Strom. So I'm quite au fait with them. I've done a lot of miles on them. I even had one of the new models in 2014, the L model. And now, I was a little bit disappointed with that. Engine was much better than the old one. It just was smaller. I'm sure Suzuki thought they were doing a really good thing making it smaller, but I just found it just not as comfortable. Having said that, I found the old V-Strom probably the most comfortable bike I've ever had in my life. So, what's it like to ride? Well, like I said, I'm pretty au fait with the V-Strom, and this new XT is everything the old V-Strom should have been. The problem with the old V-Strom, up to 2014, was the fueling. The electronic ignition and the control of it was quite bad. It was basically down to the throttle valves. They needed balancing and they went out of synchronisation within hours, it would seem. So it always was a bit lumpy. And they also had a lot of problems with the ECU units. In fact, in America, they've replaced them all with aftermarket ones. But having said that, it was still a nice bike once you got going. So this new model, I was very, very keen to compare it. And like I said, it is the bike it should have been. The fueling's excellent on it. It's got a bit more low-down power. It's got a little bit more top-end power, but that's not what it's about, I guess. Now, it's quite tall. You sit on it, and I'm 6'3", as I keep telling everyone, and it is quite difficult to touch the floor sometimes. But as I said, the seat is adjustable. Now, it feels similar to the old model with the performance. I wouldn't say it was like miles apart. Feels smoother, like I said, a lot more responsive. The throttle's much lighter and much responsive, although it can be a little jerky until you get used to it. Now, that V-Strom engine was always great at mid-range. In fact, Top Gear was always classed as an overdrive on this model, so fifth gear was the more responsive gear, and it still is. Yes, it will pull quite well in sixth gear, and the old model used to struggle in sixth gear, anything below, I would say, 50 miles an hour, but this one pulls all the way down to the bottom of the rev range and pulls all the way up again. It's a much improved bike on that. Cruise control was good. It can be a bit hit and miss on that. A lot of the new bikes. It can be a bit jerky, but it was good on this one. So once it's on the move, it feels quite light, of course, and with those wide bars and the excellent seating position, you could ride all day on it. Although the seat is perhaps not the most comfortable in the world, so maybe all day might be just a bit too far. And what about the brakes? The brakes on the old V-Strom were, let's say, adequate. In fact, on one of my bikes, I actually converted it to four-pot calipers with a little kit you could buy, and that improved it no end. But on this new model, the brakes are excellent. Even the back one's responsive as well. It's a good setup. Acceleration is quite good. As I said, get it up to the higher revs and you can feel a bit of vibration, but if you use the mid-range in short shift, it's more than adequate on any road. Now, what about the handling? Well, most adventure bikes handle quite well, but once you've got a 19-inch front wheel in the mix, it can suffer a bit, but I never did find a problem with my old V-Stroms, and this one feels just as good. It steers quite well. It's obviously no, as the Americans call it, a canyon scratcher, but it's you'd be surprised at just how well it goes and how well it handles. Road holding is excellent, of course, with those Bridgestone tyres. Now, if you do need a bit more acceleration, the gearbox is super smooth. Suzuki are renowned for their beautiful gearboxes, and no exception on this V-Strom. It feels really good. The clutch is it's light. It's got the slipper clutch, and all the modern clutches these days, is I can't believe how light they are. Sometimes I think they can't possibly work, they're so light. But yeah, the Japanese have done an excellent job of improving the clutches over the years. Now, the LCD clocks, they're big, and there's a lot on them. And for a change, you can actually see them in the sunlight. Unlike some other bikes I've tested recently. Okay, it's not TFT clocks, but it is built to a price. Talking of price, I mean, that price that it is, $11,295, that's many, many, many thousands cheaper than something similar. You can tell that by just looking around it. The frame has got metal bits welded on, and the welds aren't the best in the world, but, you know, they're functional. But if you compare it to a BMW or a KTM, you can see where the money's been spent. But, you know, people don't want a £20,000 adventure bike. Well, not everybody does. So the new XT 1050 is more than capable of doing anything that the other bikes can do for a fraction of the price. Suzuki list a load of extras, of course. Panniers, top boxes, spot lamps, heated grips. But they do tend to be a bit expensive. But no doubt, give it a year and the dealers will be offering them fully kitted out for less than the retail price. It's a shame that Suzuki have to do this, but it makes them a good buy. It doesn't do anything for the second-hand residual values, of course, but still a bike worth considering if an adventure bike is what you're looking for. You won't go far wrong on a V-Strom. I'll vouch for that.
Across the world, 24 hours a day.
Right, I'm here today with another hero of mine. I keep saying this, don't I? Another hero of mine. I've got plenty of heroes, but this time it is a real hero. It's Steve Berry, him of Top Gear fame. Welcome, Steve.
Welcome, Dave. How are you?
I'm all right. It seems just very strange, you being on the other side. It's usually, it's usually me on that other side.
Yeah, I'm kind of used to being on the other side of the table, but I quite like it on this side. It's kind of, the pressure's off me. It's all on you, mate.
That's all right. I'll put a bit of pressure on you. Come on, then. Right, okay. So, let's think. I've known you for, over 25 years.
Yeah, because before... Top Gear. We probably talk about Top Gear. I don't like to mention it. You know, I was only with the thing is, I look online as well about me on Top Gear, and the dates are all wrong, as almost everything else on the internet is. It says I was there for 7 years. I was there in total for more like 10.
Really?
Because my first appearance was October 1990. And then when everyone, including Jeremy Clarkson, got sacked off regular Top Gear at the end of 99, I stuck around for a bit doing a contractual obligation show called Top Gear GTI that used up a lot of film footage that they'd never broadcast. And then me and Vicky Butler-Henderson had sort of make items to fill the rest of the time. And we did that for a couple of years. That was really enjoyable.
Well, it was 1995 when you did that thing with me with the Z1.
Yeah.
But previous to that, if you remember...
Street Fighters.
Well, previous to that, we'd done the Top Gear radio show.
Yeah.
So when how did you start on that? What year was that? That must have been early 90s.
Yeah, we did. We did 3 years. Award-winning Top Gear radio show. A small team. Saturday mornings on BBC Radio 5. That was my first venture into radio, and I've enjoyed being on the radio ever since, really.
Well, how did you get that gig? I mean, oh, come on, let's go back to the beginning. So you're obviously a motorcyclist. You've always been a motorcyclist.
No, I've been a scoot. Well, the thing was, at one time I was the editor of Scootering Magazine, which was at the time the world's only monthly newsstand magazine devoted to classic Italian scooters, but I'd been a motorcyclist previous to that. So I'd started, like so many other people, razzing round on the fields at the back. At the back of us in Bury, there was the old Railwaymen's Club, which was derelict, and they had a big bowling green on the front of it, which we turned into a sort
of... Please don't tell me you turned a bowling green into a racetrack.
Yeah, but it wasn't. It was, Dave, it was derelict. We weren't going out on the Crown Green and razzing around and then being, you know, being arrested for our misdemeanours. No, no, it was long derelict, but we turned it into an impromptu racetrack. And we used to run round on rally wisps and all sorts of nonsense that my father would buy from the scrap man or whatever. Because a lot of people said to me, oh, yeah, Bury, that's where Jim Sandiford's was. And I was at school with Caroline Sandiford.
That's the Montessa dealer, wasn't it?
Yeah, the Montessa dealer. It was about as likely that my dad was in a position to buy me a brand new Montessa motorbike as I was to be to make the last three in a beauty contest. It just wasn't going to happen. My dad was a simple man who worked in a paper mill. He had a regular job and he had four kids. We didn't really have that sort of money to spare, but my dad would still, like I say, buy a rally wisp off the scrap man and we'd run around on the fields at the back, or I seem to remember a Suzuki at one point, and there was an old Vespa, but we immediately cut all the bodywork off that to try and lighten the thing and make it go faster. But it was really going to the classic cinema in Bury and seeing Quadrophenia in 1979, and I thought, right, I'm getting a scooter. And I overcame the inadequacy of the handling and the braking and the performance of the engine, because I thought they looked cool, and for a couple of years they did.
Yes.
Well, I remember the night, it was a night actually, that I decided that I couldn't spend the rest of my life riding around on Vespas and Lambrettas. There's a chap called Jeremy Howlett, and he owned the coolest custom scooters in the UK because he'd made a lot of money very early on in life by realising that you could sell cool American brands in the UK like Vans, Oakley, O'Neill, because his father lived in the States, and so he'd seen all this stuff, and together with his mother, they started to import it, and he made a lot of money very early on. So by the age of sort of 19, 20, he could buy whatever he liked, and he built these incredible custom scooters, but he also liked motorbikes. Mm. And I was at his house in somewhere outside London, and he said, you'll never guess what's arriving tonight, a Yamaha FNR1000 X-Up. And I thought, wow. So the van arrives. I'll never forget this. It was so weird. The van arrives. They get out one of the very first FZR1000 X-Up Yams in the country. White, pearl white, with a red and blue speed blocks. And Jeremy said to me, can you ride a motorbike? And I went, yeah. He said, do you want to go on it? And I said, yeah. Now, I'm thinking back to how weird that is. It was his bike, but he was getting me to ride it first. I think he was a bit intimidated by it.
Probably after a scooter to an FZ1000.
Yeah. Yeah. So I went up the road and I just went through the gears and I thought, I can't go back to scooters now. I can't. It was just awesome.
You were converted.
Well, that was some bike, wasn't it? I know you're a Kawasaki man, Dave, but those X-Up Yamahas at the time were pretty much state-of-the-art, weren't they?
They were. They were.
And all that horsepower, 140 brake horsepower, my God. And we were tuning these little scooter engines to try and get 25, 30 horsepower out of them, at which point they were super temperamental and really fragile. And there you were, An engine with X-Up valves and 140 brake horsepower that didn't need servicing until like 2,000 miles or 5,000, and would hold together. And later on, I owned three examples of that bike myself, and big old buses. I had a Thunder Ace, which is essentially a development of the Thunder Ace 1000. And I love that bike because it wasn't just for razzing around on a Sunday. I used that bike as transport even when I could afford decent cars. Yeah. I'd think, oh, I've got to go down to Brands Hatch, do something, report on something that's going on there, and get back to Manchester in a day. I'll take the Thunder Ace. It was such a good long-distance bike.
So how did the radio thing come into it?
Well, telly came before radio. I got on the telly because at the time I was working for the company that published Scootering magazine. I'd moved on to bikes. We were doing Street Fighters magazine, which was kind of the high performance Japanese. I'm trying to think who invented the Street Fighter.
Yeah, somebody who fell off a sports bike and couldn't afford the fairings.
Right, I'm gonna name three people who are here in the northwest of England. One of them's Odgy, who was the editor of Backstreet Heroes, part of the custom car scene here in the UK before he did that. Backstreet Heroes being a traditional custom bike magazine. The other one's Nick Coulton from West Coast Motorcycles in Southport. Again, he's been on my show. Well-known biking personality, particularly here in the northwest. And the other one is a chap called Robert Clark, better known as Clink, who was one of the writers for Backstreet Heroes magazine when it was all about choppers, Harley-Davidson engines, British twin engines, long forks, metal flake paint jobs, that sort of thing. Between them, they saw the custom trend that was coming in from Japan based on American superbike racing. Magazines like Clubman in Japan were publishing photos. We couldn't read Japanese, any of us, so we didn't know what they were saying, but we could see what they were doing. They were basing street bikes on, like, American superbikes, four-cylinder, across-the-frame Japanese American superbikes from the 80s. So the sort of Eddie Lawson, Wes Cooley replicas, stuff like that, Bubba Sherbert, but road bikes based on those race bikes, stripped down, flat bars, single-seat units, street fighters. I reckon that between them, they cooked up the idea of the street fighter. And like you said, a lot of street fighters, early ones, got done because people binned their bike and then looked at how much the fairings and the handlebars were, put some motocross handlebars on it and carried on riding it. I did that myself. Not intentionally. I binned a 750 Yamaha and it was going to be so expensive to replace all the plastic. I just put some rentals on it and a generic headlight and carried on riding.
Well, Backstreet Heroes, it was Manchester based. It was in Altrincham, wasn't it?
Yeah, and that's how I ended up on the telly, because I met one of the series producers of Top Gear in the newsagent. I used to go into work every morning, and because I came in, I was the only one who came in from the north of Altrincham, where the magazine was based. Everybody else seemed to live east, south, west, and the only place you could buy a pint of milk was in the north of the town. So it was my job to stop every morning, because I don't think we had a fridge, get a pint of milk so that we had some milk for our tea. We're British. Yeah. We need our tea. We're fueled by tea.
Sterilised milk.
No, we got fresh milk every day because I'd stop. And I got chatting to this chap called Dennis in the newsagents, because I'm quite a chatty type, you may have noticed.
Really?
And he told me that he had a Lotus Cortina, which impressed me hugely, which he raced. And he also had a BMW motorcycle, which didn't impress me, because I was in my, if it's not got huge horsepower and it's not four cylinders and it doesn't make a really nasty, loud sound, I'm not interested. So back in, then the other thing, of course, Dave, is for guys our age, is what the cops rode. BMWs were what the cops rode. Yes. The guy who pulled you over and gave you a hard time was on a blinking BMW. It might have been a Nought, an Interpol or a Triumph Saint or something like that previously. But in our era, it was always an air-cooled BMW that the cops used to pull you over on. So I wasn't that interested in his BMW, but he insisted on telling me about it. And one day I went in, and and he was in there. And as I was leaving, he sort of chased me out the shop and he said, "Do you know what I do?" I said, "No, Dennis, I've no idea what you do." And he said, "I'm one of the producer directors on Top Gear." And I went, "Great." Like, and I was getting on my bike. And he subsequently told me it was that I was so not bothered. You know, I was like, "Yeah, great, well done." And he kind of said, "Well, I think you'd be a good presenter on it." And I went, "Okay." And that was kind of it.
That was it.
Yeah. I went down. They did a bit of a screen test with me. And it's like, I think you've said this before, some things pass into legend, although there's very little basis in truth. And even though you know the truth, you decide to stick with a legend because it's a better story.
Yeah, never let the truth get in front of a good story.
Yeah. So the bit that's been repeated to me loads of times is that at my screen test with a load of other people, I was presented with the latest Mazda RX-7. I think it was the Gen 2 car. No, hold on, Gen 3. Gen 3 car. So that was the one with the double bubble roof. And it was quite a step up in price from previous models of the RX-7. And what they asked us to do was to create a one-minute presentation. But they sprung the car on us, me and a few other people. I recognised two of them as TV presenters. One was a DJ from Radio 1. The other one had seen him on TV. The mistake they'd made is not being journalists.
Yeah.
And so when asked to create a story, if you will, about that vehicle that would last a minute, they hadn't got a clue.
Right.
So I just set to and scribbled some notes on a piece of paper, memorised it. They put the camera on me. I did my blurb about Mazda. And then I jumped up on the roof and said, not bad from the same people that brought you light bulbs.
Yeah, good.
Now, the payoff, the punchline's true. That was the punchline. But I didn't think that jumping up on the roof of a brand new car, which even at the time, and this would have been early 90s, retailed for the thick end of 35,000 quid,
yeah,
would have done me too many favours. But I've had so many people say, yeah, yeah, you got the job because you jumped up on the roof and did the last line from the top of the car. And I now just go, yeah. Yeah, yeah,
yeah. So you meant that. Yeah.
So whatever.
No, that's good. Now, did they expect you to just do cars, or was you brought on to do motorcycles?
Bikes. I was brought on to. I can't tell this story. There'll be a day when I can tell the story about what happened to the guy before me who did bikes, but it's not now because everyone's still alive and everyone would still get upset.
Oh.
Yeah. So they brought me on, and here was the thing: the first item that I did was a blinking BMW.
How ironic.
Yeah, so they got me to review, and I had to say nice things about it. And here's the thing. When you actually do that, you realise two things. One, I have a regional accent. Because yeah. Everybody else was like public school types, like Jeremy Clarkson and Quentin Wilson and Tiff Nidell. Mm. When you've got somebody who's using the nickname that his nanny gave him, or, you know, whatever it is, you think... Yeah, why? What's he called? No, his real name's Timothy. Well, why did they call him Tiff? Well, because that's what his nanny called him or something. I'm like, what? You know, I'm from Bury. Mm-hmm. My dad worked in a paper mill. When you walked out of our house, it was like Coronation Street. You walked straight onto the street.
Yeah.
You know, I had no idea about that sort of world of posh cars and posh people and all that. So you realise you've got a regional accent. And it's been both a blessing and a curse for me. And the other thing you realise is that you walk funny. I walked funny at first.
I never noticed that.
Dude, I look back at those first items and I think, why am I walking like that? I'm walking towards the bike and I'm moving my right leg and right arm forward at the same time. Like, you know what I'm thinking? That's shocking. So try not to do... You become conscious. Oh. I tried not to do as much walking or as much moving. I now look at a lot of YouTubers who do stuff about cars and bikes, and they can't control their body language. I mean, the best example is probably that Doug DeMuro guy. I mean, he's... Right, you have to be a certain age to get this, but the first time I watched Doug DeMuro, who's an incredibly popular motoring YouTuber, I thought, bloody hell, it's Magnus Pike. Do you remember him, Dave? Dr. Magnus Pike, back in the day. So much movement in the guy, you know, in the guy's... I tried not to do that, but, yeah.
So you went on from there. Obviously, that finished.
Hold on.
I mean, then you moved on to other TV work. You was...
I decided that the problem with being a presenter is that you can get sacked like that. I mean, I was there for, like I say, the thick end of 10 years on and off. I worked on Top Gear Motorsport, the Top Gear Radio Show, the Bikes the Star. Did all kinds of work there at the BBC. And they basically tossed me aside like a used Kleenex. And I thought, damn it, this is the problem because... And, of course, this came back to bite organisations like the BBC on the bum. And it's a bit like racing in a way, where everybody's employed except the talent.
Yeah.
So you're like a racing driver. You're just hired on a very short contract.
Yeah.
And if they want to get rid of you for whatever reason. I mean, I remember a guy, he didn't work on Top Gear, but he worked on a very well-known BBC TV show. And he basically got thrown out because the boss was at home watching that. I was going to say which day it was, but that'd give away what the programme was. The boss was, so I won't do that. The boss was at home watching the show with his missus, and his missus said, "Who's that? I don't like him." And this boss, this guy who was the boss, thought, "Oh, well, that's the voice of the people speaking. So I'm going to get rid of that guy." And he sacked him like that. So I thought, what you've got to do is you've got to listen to the bloke who used to drink in my local here in Salford, old Karl Marx and his mate Frederick Engels, drinking in the Crescent on Chapel Street. You've got to take controls of the means of production. You've got to become a producer and a director. So that's what I did. I started directing stuff, producing stuff, trying to make my own shows.
Yeah.
You know, the same way as if you like work in a shop and then you get excited and you think, oh, I'll start my own shop.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But then you're, which obviously you've done, although I don't think you got sacked.
Well, my job.
And I just thought, I've got to do my own thing. But the problem then is, Dave, is that you end up in rooms with people trying to convince them that what they need to do is give you quite a big pile of money so that you can make programmes about motorbikes.
Yeah.
And that ain't easy.
I know. My old boss used to say, why should I sponsor people? Why should I be paying somebody to enjoy themselves? And at the time, I didn't get it, but yeah, I get it now. Why should you be paying somebody to enjoy themselves?
Yeah, and I it's difficult, but I think, again, we're talking about things that are a blessing or a curse. I've got three motorbike TV programmes in development, and that means that I've, like any business person, had to spend my own money to try and develop them, because not everyone will work for free. Certain costs are unavoidable. And what I'm trying to do is create something that's kind of broadcast quality. And yet when I switch on the internet, I see lots of people holding their phone at arm's length going, yeah, this is the new whatever it is, let's have a look at it. And then just holding their phone and moving around the bike and then putting the phone on a clamp on the handlebars and expecting me to sit there and listen to them talking about this bike, just stream of consciousness, no editing at all, and looking at a view of kind of suburban England or suburban America while they just go round the block. And I think, I can't help but think, Dave, that's not worth people's time. The stuff that I want to do is stuff that's broadcast quality, where it's kind of, you know, there's quite a bit of effort has gone into thinking about what it is and using. I know some really great cameramen, and so I want to use those guys to show how beautiful motorcycles can be, instead of someone just... I'm not saying they shouldn't just pick up their phone, and actually I am. They shouldn't just pick up the phone.
Yeah, but have you seen some of the viewings on them? They're in thousands and thousands and thousands.
I don't get it. I think it's much more to do with the personality of the people that are doing them. And I've had people say to me, you should just do that. You should just switch your phone. And I'm like, I can't. I can't.
Yeah.
I was at the BBC all that time and they did things properly. And I don't really want to do it. I'd rather try and, you know, do something decent. One of the things that I want to do, since you asked, Dave, thank you for asking, is...
Did I ask?
You did.
Did I get a chance?
You did. Is a version... One of the best car programmes that's ever been on TV was called Victory by Design. It was hosted by a guy who's a keen motorcyclist as well, Alan de Cadenet. And it was a fantastic show about cars. Great driving, great cinematography in it, beautifully edited, beautifully shot. He's a really good presenter, and they did cars. You know, they did Jaguar, they did Lotus, they did Maserati. I want to do the bike equivalent of that. I want to tell the story of some of the great marks of motorcycling, MV Agusta, Norton, shameful what's happening with Norton, Ducati, Moto Guzzi, BMW, I'm going to say BMW, Harley-Davidson. Present it in that way, a way that is... What was great about Victory by Design was that it was made with great production values, but unlike a lot of shows with amazing production values, it wasn't dumbed down to appeal to the masses. It kind of assumed that you, if you were watching it, you knew something about these great cars. You knew quite a bit about these great cars. You didn't need to be held by the hand and to have every single little thing explained to you, i.e. it wasn't like current Top Gear with the lifeguard from Orich Baths and that cricket player fella.
Yes. I know. Well, Steve, that brings us to the end of part one of this little, I'm going to say interview, but it's more of a chat, really, isn't it? And we'll be talking more next week.
This is Fab Radio International. Embrace the alternative.
Now we've got this week's top 10, and this week it's Dave's top 10 Kawasaki models. Number 10, Ninja H2 Supercharged.
Yes, just because of its mind-numbing power, speed, handling, and delivery. Everybody should ride one before they die. Preferably not on one, of course. Yep, Ninja H2. It looks good, it rides good, and by golly, it does you good.
Number 9, KH400, 1977.
Ah yes, the 400 triple two-stroke. Not the fastest of the triples, of course, but probably the best all-round package. Green and purple in that year, the very best colours.
Number 8, H2750, 1973.
Yes, the big daddy of the triples, and the most valuable, of course. Its mad two-stroke power band is unbelievable, and also nearly uncontrollable. They didn't call it the Widowmaker for nothing.
Number 7, H1500, 1969.
The only bike that tried to kill me on every bend I took. Bad handling, bad brakes, lousy fuel consumption, but so, so cool. But should have come with an health warning, I think.
Number 6, Z1000, 1977.
Yes, my first Kawasaki, and made me feel like the king of the road. Although stepping up from a CB250 G500 can do that for you. Oh, it made me the happiest 18-year-old in the world.
Number 5, ZZR 1100.
Yeah, I had loads of them. I travelled all over Europe on them. It's the first bike I did over 185 miles an hour on. Still a good bike today.
Number 4, ZZR 1400.
Sublime power, incredible speed, and a good handling bike. I put a turbo on one and did over 200 miles per hour. So fast and now so cheap. Again, buy one while you can.
Number 3, GPZ 900R, 1984.
A real game changer for Kawasaki. We went from GPZ 1100 dinosaurs to racer spec speed and handling. It had a long model run as well. And it's still a good all-round bike. Buy one now. It's definitely a future classic.
Number 2, Z1300, six-cylinder.
You know, I was lucky enough to own a new Z1300 and a new CBX Honda in the same year, 1979. Okay, the CBX was prettier and it handled better, but it couldn't compare with the Z1300. The Kawasaki Z1300, the power and the glory.
Number 1, 1973 Z1900.
What can I say? The original superbike still looks as good today as it did 47 years ago. Not only did it put Kawasaki on the map, it also started my career and turned me into a lifelong Z-head. Long live the king.
Right, that's it for now. Thanks, Dave.
Hi, my name's Pip Iron. I'm an aging motorcycle drag racing has-been. I just love to listen to Dave Marsden on Motorcycle Views on Fab Radio International. You know, it's Europe's greatest independent radio station.
Okay, I'm back again this week with Kev Johnson. By popular demand, he's back. Right, Kev, we're going to talk about some of the bikes you've owned. Last week you told us about that FS1E that you fell in love with. A bit of a love story going on there. So I've got a bit of a list here of what you had. And first one up, a Suzuki TS100. You said you was into small bikes, but... TS100?
Yeah, I know, it's really sad. HEN747N, I even remember the reg. Bought the bike, it was a go-to-work bike, I just loved it. And not particularly quick bike, it was just such a sweet little bike, and it served me very, very well. After that, followed a few CB125s, I actually sort of fell for those, but I can actually rebuild one really well now. The camshafts always used to fall out, the cylinder heads.
Talking about rebuilding, what about that CB100 you sold to that good friend of yours?
Oh, the CB100. Well, a good friend of mine at the time decided he wanted to buy this bike for going to work on. So he bought this CB100, and he lived at the bottom of a hill. And every morning he'd go to work, the engine had cut out within 10 feet of the same place every morning. Give it a minute, it started again, and off he went. Oh, he got angry with it sometimes, though. All it turned out to be was a tight exhaust valve. Amazing. And it cut out to within 10 feet the same place every morning. Oh, we did laugh about that one.
And why was that? Because the valve was tightening up and just getting no compression.
When he set off from cold, the engine was all cold, so he'd set off to go up the hill and the engine was obviously working. The exhaust valve's the first thing to get really hot in an engine, and it just expanded up, held itself open, engine stopped.
Well, we are talking about Ian Wright here, a mutual friend of ours. I mean, he'd kick himself if he could.
He had
anger issues.
He had anger issues, and he did kick and jump on the bike a few times, much to our amusement.
So you went on then to a couple of CB125s.
Yeah, the CB125s, they were just a bit of a great little workhorse. Well, we had it at the time. Cracking little bikes, and I'd love to come across one now, to be honest, but they're even pulling great money. A CB125S L registration. I've still got in my garage a bent valve. It's up on my little shelf of trophies. A bent valve out of the BTF 51L.
You should straighten that out and put it on eBay.
I should do, really. Shouldn't that be worth a fortune?
And then you moved on to a real bike here, a Honda 250 Super Dream.
Yeah.
You're admitting it.
Yeah, I did.
A deluxe model.
It was, well, here's a question for you there, Dave. What was the difference between the Super Dream, not standard, and Super Dream Deluxe?
Whoa. Hondas. Actually, I did know a bit about Hondas. I think they had reverse Comstar wheels.
Correct.
They had like a little bit of a tailpiece with a wing on it, like the 900 and 750. And limited edition black colour. Can't remember the colour of the stripes.
Absolutely though. Stunned by your knowledge. Yes, correct, on all three counts.
Yeah.
It was a cracking little bike. It wouldn't pull very hard, but it just did what it did, and it was the deluxe model. I even had engine bars on it at the time.
Well, even them are going for stupid money now.
Oh, it's ridiculous.
Yeah. Especially the deluxe model.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, what have you got here now? Yamaha RD250E.
Yeah, I'd always wanted a Yamaha. I loved the RD range. I managed to come by an RD250E. A silver one, not a particularly popular colour, but it was a really, really good bike. They were quite heavy, actually, the RDs, the RD range. I always, and I still hanker after 400, but the 400s are getting crazy money at the moment.
Yeah, they went for like £7,000, £8,000 for a good one.
Absolutely mad money. It was a great, clean bike, that. What I should have kept, one of those, the list of bikes I've got, we talked about what the bike did you hate losing, and I can point to any one of 15 bikes on there that I wish I'd never sold.
So then you moved down a bit to a DT175MX?
Well, I wouldn't say moved down. I had them both at the same time, and then the RD got sold. But the DT was my introduction into off-roading. As you know, I'd done quite a lot of off-roading in my time. But the DT was the way into it. ADJ21T. It was lovely. And it introduced me into a trail bike class for doing some off-road riding. Enjoyed it. Really enjoyed it.
So what was next then after that?
The followed on after that, and I think you remember this one, the Suzuki GS550.
Oh yeah, I remember that. You came to a couple of the vintage Japanese motorcycle club meetings on that.
I did indeed. I was thrashing the living daylights out of it, trying to keep up with you lads on the big bikes. Beautiful bike, lovely bike. And I actually remember selling it at one of the Stafford shows. I wasn't particularly selling it as such, but it was there. And I sort of made my mind up at the time, I thought, and a guy came along and wanted it for his wife. I said, yeah, go on, crack on. It was a lovely, lovely bike.
So then you moved down again to a CB250 RS Honda.
Yeah, well, I did. I'm back on the 250s again. I think it was a go-to-work thing, and there was one came up. It was a blue one, really immaculate, and I thought, they handle so well. The little 250 single RSs handle so well, really light, not big power, but it did me really, really well. It was okay.
And then you must have had a bang on the head and come to your senses, because then you bought a Kawasaki, GBZ 600R.
They'd just come out at the time. It was a B registration. and I just got offered the guy was after a change, and he bought this bike, and he wasn't particularly keen on it. And I said, look, I've got a 250 RS, would you like to see it? And when it wasn't in the days of email or anything. So I just met him on the M62, and he had his GPZ. I said, I'll have it. And he said, I'll have that as well. And away I came. Had that for a while, that GPZ. It was lovely.
That sounds a bit iffy to me, but there you go. I suppose you did in those days. There was no internet or anything,
no,
was
nothing
it?
Nothing like
you
that.
You just met people and did deals.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you've next bike, you've moved back to the trail bike there, a Yamaha XT600.
Yeah, I'm coming back into my roots. I know we mentioned last week I had the Triumph Tiger. This was really the start of it proper. The XT Tenere was the 600 single with the big tank, and it was something I always hankered after. Loved the bike, fantastic bike. Not really as quick as you'd think they would be, just a big 600 single, but it was a really nice, tidy bike to ride, but I enjoyed that big style of bike, the trail bike style, and that was probably the start of my trail bikes there.
So next up is, and I remember this because you had it delivered in a box, a Suzuki 1200 Bandit.
Yeah, we went a bit potty. Actually, the lad who I bought the we bought them at the same time. The 1200 Bandit was a fabulous bike. It was built to a price. It was a good old. It was a good price. You could get them at the right money at the time. They were I wouldn't say a budget bike, but very, very strong engine. I know Steve Webster used to run a 1200 Bandit engine in his sidecar. I know the lad that tuned his engine, and he said you can just go to the sky with these things. Very, very quick bike, and it was so nice to ride.
Yeah, they were good bikes. In fact, Ian Wright bought his because he'd decided he'd be going too fast on his ZZR 1200 or 1100 he had at the time, and he was going to slow down. He ended up going even faster on that Bandit.
Well, we bought the two at the same time together. They arrived in boxes and we put them together. We enjoyed the experience of doing that. It was lovely. It was nice.
So next up is another obscure bike, Yamaha XV750.
Okay, so
V-twin.
We discussed bikes. I've not restored all the many, probably about 8 bikes, but that was one of the first ones that I restored. It was Yamaha's first attempt at a custom bike, and it came up with the right money, clean, everything there, but it was overcomplicated. They never really ran perfectly. The car was horrendous to set up, and I probably put a little bit too much money into it. But as a custom bike, it wasn't a bad first attempt, and it was the pre-runner to the Virago. It was a nice thing. It probably fetched good money nowadays. Its big brother at the time, of course, was the TR1. But it was a good little bike, but I didn't enjoy restoring that one.
Next up, and we're just going to go straight past it, Z750 twin. Right, next one, Honda VFR 750.
So I hankered after a V4 at this stage, and you probably remember me having this Honda.
I do.
It was the one of the first Pro-Am ones, so I'd always read the reports on the old normal swing arm model. Well, the VFR came out and I absolutely loved it. It was a red one with white wheels and absolutely stunning. It was a very comfortable bike to ride. We did a lot of miles together on that bike.
So the next one was the one we spoke about last week. It was the Triumph Tiger.
Yeah.
As I said, he was a trendsetter by being the first of our group who had a big adventure bike.
The Triumph Tiger. Wonderful bike. I can't speak highly enough of it. I know the new ones are a lot nicer now, but that for in the day, that was a fabulous, fabulous bike. Rolling on from the Tiger, I got a Triumph Thunderbird, was the same engine, the 900 engine, in a more of a low sort of custom style of bike, as we all know what a Thunderbird is. Really nice to ride. But mine had the straight through exhaust on it, which gave it that little rasp, and it was so nice. But a really comfortable bike.
Next one's a bike that's gone down in folklore for probably all the wrong reasons.
Yeah.
Suzuki TL1000S.
Well, so the reports at the time said it's a killer and it's a terrible bike to ride and everything. I got mine and just fell in love with it from the moment I went up the road. The power was fabulous. It never bothered me with the head shake and, the backing up of the suspension. And it ran so well. I really wish I still had that bike.
Yeah, again, another bike that's become a bit of a classic and fetching really good money. So next one, another Triumph, Sprint 900.
I didn't have that for too long. It was one that I got later on, and I just bought it, and then I ran it for a while and sold it. Wasn't really what I really wanted in that style of bike. But moving on from that, I bought brand new from your friend Keith Mason, an XJR 1300.
I remember that. Did your brother also have one?
Yes, he did. He had a yellow and black one. I bought the blue with the silver engine.
Oh, the Saren replica.
Yes, that's
it. Of course, to the Kenny Roberts.
Mine was the blue one. Oh, it's fabulous. Love
that. No, I had one of them.
Bit of a pussycat.
Yeah.
Bit of a pussycat.
Bit ponderous. Yeah. Handling a bit.
Yeah, wayward.
Yeah.
But it made for an excited day.
Yeah. And then, of course, as we said last week, you got old. Like the rest of us. So the next one up on the list, BMW R1200 GS.
Well, I got mine just before Jelly Bowman and Ewan McGregor did the little trip out, and that's my claim to fame. I bought mine, so I just really had a hankering for this big trail bike BMW, and it was lovely, it was fabulous. Went off down the road on it. I actually bought it used. It had a few miles on it when I bought it. We went, well, we've done a lot of miles on that one. And that actually led on
Hang on, it can't be that good. You sold it. Oh, no, hang on. You sold it in Gort.
Well, what happened was, I was going to service it. We're off to France. And I actually went to the dealership just for a new sump plug washer. And I came out with the triple black Adventure. I thought, I've got to have that. I love it. And I actually still have that today, as you know.
Was it much more than the washer for the sump plug?
It was a little bit more, yeah. Well, it wasn't that. I had to tell the missus, and it was a bit of a stinger.
That's got to be Dave Foster at Williams BMW.
Yes, it is indeed.
He can sell anything.
Sell to the Arabs. But thanks, Dave, for that.
So what about some of your off-road bikes?
Oh, right. Well, long history with it. I have a long history of off-roading anyway. Always done it. So I've gone through a whole list of Husqvarnas from early 390, CR390s.
Well, hang on, what about this Malaguti Grizzly?
That was one that we mentioned it last week, obviously, but it was one that I bought in a box, and I was doing it for my son, and it was an awkward little thing to work on. And I've only just got rid of it, actually. But it was immaculate when I finished it. And it got him started when he was a youngster, probably 4-year-old, riding around the field. But we couldn't get... The kiddies' bike weren't plentiful then. So we decided to go for that one.
And then you went. You had a bit of a spell going through strange ones, Husqvarnas and Armstrongs.
Yeah. Well, my Husqvarna, I used that in enduros for a while, and it got a bit tatty, and I stripped it all back, and we did it all, and we'll obviously clean the engine up and everything. And it got put together really, really well. But then I sold it after that. And I bought another one, but that one got sold. I sort of wish I'd hung on to that one. But it was just me starting my enduro days, really. But more interesting one, just after that one, I came across a Suzuki GT250B. Do you remember that?
Well, it's not an off-road bike.
No, it's not. Well, I had a mix at the time. And I couldn't resist it. This was an XAA demonstration bike that they used to take the wheels out of and show the AA men at the time how to, you know, change the tyre and, you know, what where the fuses were. And it came up for sale, and it had 185 miles, original miles on it. They must have been playing about with the mixture screws, because one of the header pipes was seriously blue and the other one was all right. It took a little bit of setting up, but what an absolutely pristine bike. Probably another one I wish I hung on to.
And I can see on this list there's another Kawasaki here. Oh, a KDX 200.
Yeah. I bought that off our friend, a friend at the time, Doug Hacking Motorcycles in Bolton.
Oh, yeah, sadly departed a few years ago.
Yeah, what a lovely guy Doug was. Right in the middle of the enduro days, I was actually doing a bit of the championship, the British Championships then, and I decided to go for a... I came off the four strokes and tried it on a KDX 200 for a while. It was a nice bike. It was lovely.
And then you went through another Honda period. We talked about that XR 600 you bought from Steve Parris last week, didn't we?
Yeah. See? Well, that XR 600 actually led on to... I moved on to a 450 because I needed more of the power in the class I was in at the time. And then I came away from that for a little while. I bought a Yamaha, the Yamaha WR426. What a terrible bike. Wouldn't start when it was hot. If you pleaded with it, it would not start when it was hot. Kept it for a little while, and in the end, I'd just had enough. They went over to electric start later on. That moved on then to what they call it in America, the Red Pig, I believe they call it, the XR650.
Oh, yeah, I remember that, with the red engine and everything.
Well, no, it was a silver engine. The red engines were in the Elsinores. But it was a big bike, heavy, water-cooled 650. Me and my brother bought one each at the same time. What a lovely bike that was. It was we did big bike rallies on that. Very, very quick and super smooth.
Well, still a single cylinder, not the V12.
Still a single cylinder, water cooled, yeah. But quite heavy for an off-road bike. Aluminium frame, but nice bike. Great for big bike rallies. And riding deserts, I suppose, really.
And then you had a few trail bikes as well, didn't you? Well, trails bikes.
Well, I started off years ago. I got onto an old Bultaco 250 and I really enjoyed it. Never any good at trials. I was never up to Wayne's level, shall we say, although he was in the sidecar.
Oh, Mr. Kershaw.
Indeed.
He'd be listening.
He was, and Ross. And then I went through a whole string of them. I had an Armstrong 320. That was nice with the Sammy Miller engine in it. And a 250 Aprilia. That was one that actually I cleaned up. That came out really well. A TY250 for a short time. And then we moved on to more modern stuff. And I had two GasGas 250s. I had one and my son had one.
Were they Spanish?
Yes. Funnily enough, I went to Barcelona not that long ago. Went straight past the GasGas factory. What an interesting place that is. Huge. Anyway, the 250 GasGas is what a great bike.
Well, that brings us to the end of your list of bikes, but I've got a question for you. If money was no object, I know it's no object with you anyway, but what bike would you buy? Road bike.
A road bike, right. Bizarrely enough, I'd probably buy a Fat Boy.
Oh, dear me.
I know, sorry, Dave. But it's not my favoured bike. I've just always hankered for one. I've never had one, and I'm not particularly rushing out to buy one. I don't know.
That's up there with your 250 Super Dream Deluxe.
Well, Fat Boy Deluxe. Probably the bike you've got at the moment, which is the 1250 GS.
No, you've got to stick to that Fat Boy now.
Oh, we'll go with the Fat Boy then.
You've lost all credibility now, man. You're just doing so well.
Oh dear.
Well, that's it, Kev. That's all we've got time for. It was a pleasure to speak to you again. But hopefully we can do it again sometime.
You know, Dave, it's always good to catch up with you. Thank you very much for the time.
So, guys, that's the end of the show. But before we leave, I'll give you the answer to that question I asked earlier. The question, if you remember, was what bike won the first AMA Superbike Series in 1976? Well, funny enough, it was a BMW. A BMW R90S, ridden by our very own Brit guy, Reg Pridmore. He went on to win it in 77, in 78 as well, but on a Kawasaki. Anyway, I hope you'll enjoyed listening to the show, and I hope you'll join in next week. Until then, goodbye and stay safe.
Coming up next is the Ripman Show with Paul Ripley. He'll be playing music from 1969 to 1979.